This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 104.
Ask any five-year-old what they're the best at in the world, and they'll tell you, I'm the best at soccer, I'm the best at hugs, I'm the best at everything. Because as a child, you haven't learned how to compare, despair. You don't have a self-awareness about your flaws or your doubts. In chapter 2 of the book, we identified 6 forces that hold people back. They pop up between the ages of 8 and 12. They pop up in your adolescence. Men, women, everybody, non-binary, everybody has these 6 forces that hold them back, and they form the basis of an inner critic, one that stays with you for the rest of your life. And so if you fast forward as an adult, if I asked you what you're the best at in the world, and again, that's the true basis, having a mindset that you know what you bring to the table before it becomes a behavior, you're stumped. Most people are stumped when I say, what are you the best at in the world? They're like, I haven't thought, but if I tell you what your flaws are, you got a long list of your flaws. We went on this journey to say, can we help people articulate the answer to that question? Because you can't be confident. You can't perform until you truly believe it in yourself.
How could feedback lead to personal and professional growth? Why should HR leaders be more confident in who they are and the value they deliver? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Hey friend, before I get to this week's episode, I want to take a moment and tell you why I think you need to be reserving your spot at Elevate by Future of HR. Elevate by Future of HR is an exclusive 3-week virtual program specifically designed for next-gen HR leaders. My goal with Elevate by Future of HR is to reimagine professional development for next-gen HR leaders like yourself. We all know that we can do more to invest in ourselves as professionals and invest in our HR teams, and this is an opportunity to do just that. Elevate is a flexible and targeted 3-week program featuring 18 interactive sessions, live Q&As for personalized guidance, and 22 of the best minds in our field. In addition, you'll have on-demand access to the recordings in all sessions through March 31st, 2025. This is an incredible opportunity to accelerate your growth, elevate your career, and amplify your impact with actionable insights and strategies from 22 thought leaders. So who will you be learning from at Elevate? Well, here are just a few examples. Michael Watkins will share the 6 disciplines of strategic thinking. Charlene Lee will share how AI will transform HR. Kevin Cox will talk about what defines the world-class CHRO. Humaira Malik Shahid will talk about embedding DEI into talent practices. And Mark Efron will tell you why doing these 3 very difficult things is the key to career success. We also have another 17 amazing speakers at Elevate, so you don't want to miss this incredible development experience. Go to elevatebyfutureofhr2024.com. That's elevatebyfutureofhr2024.com and reserve your spot today. And for those of you who are looking to make a big impact on your team's development, we also have group discounts and affordable enterprise licenses available, which would give your entire HR team the opportunity to experience Elevate. My guest this week is Lisa Sun. Lisa is an entrepreneur and founder and CEO of Gravitas, a company on a mission to catalyze confidence. Gravitas offers innovative size-inclusive apparel, and Lisa's often been called the dress whisperer. But she's also a highly sought-after public speaker, and she has written a terrific book called Gravitas, The 8 Strengths That Redefine Confidence. In her book, Gravitas, Lisa shares her journey from receiving a transformative performance review to launching her own company. And along the way, she shares what she has learned from a research-based approach around the 8 strengths that redefine confidence. I will tell you this, Lisa is a powerhouse and a true inspiration. I know you're going to love this conversation and enjoy it just as much as I did as we discussed why feedback is a gift that can lead to personal and professional growth, why confidence is not about external validation, but about understanding and appreciating your own abilities, how the traditional definition of confidence often leads to a double standard, why expanding the scorecard of success and redefining the metrics of confidence can create a more inclusive and equitable workplace, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn or just say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Lisa. Lisa, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being on the podcast. You've got a really impressive background. I knew a book out. So we want to sit down with you and get to know you a little bit better. And what I was really interested to know more about as I read the book was you said in your first annual review, performance review, as a business analyst at McKinsey & Company, it changed your life. So tell us more about how a performance review changed your life, because I think that is really interesting.
I spent 11 years of my 23-year professional career at McKinsey & Company, the management consulting firm. So a little less than half of my time, and it was my first job out of college. My first annual performance review, it was about 1 year after I'd been there. The opening line was, Lisa comes across as young and overly enthusiastic at times. She should seek to have more gravitas. And I think all of us have been at some point told to have more confidence, right? Gravitas is dignity, importance. It's a code word for how confident you are. I always say feedback is a gift. Only your best coaches take enough time to care about you to give you feedback. When I asked my boss at the time, how do you get gravitas? She said, oh, go buy a new dress, wear big jewelry and great shoes, which is a little bit offensive for someone making $43,000 a year, size 18-20, that your boss just tells you to buy new clothes. But when I asked her why, I said, why do you think I need new clothes? She said, okay, it's really not about the clothes. It's every morning when you look in the mirror, you're the first person you have to look at and you have to like yourself. I can teach you how to be good at this job, but I can't teach you how to believe in yourself. Dumbo did not need a feather to fly. It reminded him that he could. That really changed my life because it really was confidence is not about how others see you, it's how you see yourself first. And then that translates into a set of behaviors that others can see. And I spent over 2 decades from boardrooms to dressing rooms. My company now, we're a fashion lifestyle content company. We focus primarily on our mission, which is we catalyze confidence. That first professional review was transformative because it set me on a journey to really pursue my ultimate purpose and mission in life.
That's amazing. And I'm curious, did you feel like you weren't confident in when you got that review? Were you kind of like, huh? You worked at McKinsey. You were really smart. You're working at one of the best management consulting firms in the business.
This is the ultimate crux of the issue and why I decided to write the book. When we have talked about confidence for hundreds of years, and it's mostly been framed as a behavior. When someone tells you to be more confident, you speak up, you stand on a stage, you're assertive. It's a very external expression. If you look up the word confident in the dictionary, it has nothing to do with performance, bravado, or swagger. It's an understanding of appreciation of and trust in your own abilities. So most of us have been taught to be what I call performatively confident, be assertive, have swagger, have bravado, have charisma, extroversion. But ultimately, and I answered a question for someone who said, I've always thought of you as a very confident 20 or 30 year old. I've known you for 2 decades. And I said, that doesn't take away from the fact that I was an insecure overachiever, looking for external validation, beating myself up, a dark inner critic. You can be both. You can be performatively, externally extroverted and charismatic and assertive, but that doesn't mean you like yourself or that you're secure in your own abilities or that you feel that you can cope with fear, setback, and be resilient.
It's well said. It is a really interesting paradox, right? You can have both those two things existing at the same time.
That's where we as a society have gotten it wrong for so long. In 2013, Janet Yellen was nominated to be the first woman head of the Federal Reserve. And there were hundreds of articles written about how she, quote unquote, did not have the gravitas to lead the Fed. And I really appreciated Ezra Klein, who was at the time at the Washington Post. He wrote an op-ed that basically said the pervasive view of gravitas doesn't stretch to include her. She's soft-spoken. She's collaborative. By the way, she's the most qualified for the job. Why do we only label gravitas as extroverted, charismatic qualities? For me, it really is when we say confidence, the quietest person in the room could actually be the most secure and self-assured.
It's really true. I mean, we definitely focus too much on confidence versus competence, and we fall for people who are really overly confident, who are loud, who are, like you said, clamoring for the attention or taking over that meeting. And we fall for it a lot in interviews and in leadership, and it's unfortunate. I do kind of want to talk a little more about how you went from McKinsey consultant to launching Gravitas. And it sounds like you had some early obstacles because starting a business is not easy, but tell us a little about what that was like.
I always say very few of us are built to be entrepreneurs. I think we've made entrepreneurs into heroes, and really, it's a really tough job to choose. You eat glass and stare into the abyss all day and really have to be driven by purpose. So I had spent 11 years at McKinsey, and I had an 11-month accumulated paid leave, and I decided to take a paid leave, which I know is a luxury. Most of us don't get a chance to take almost a year off. And I went around the world by myself. I actually joke, in 2011 to 2012, I still had a BlackBerry. I loved that thing. I went around the world with a stack of books and a BlackBerry. And my mom, when I went to visit my parents in Taiwan, my mom convinced me to take my life savings and start my own business. And she told me to bet on myself. So I love the fact that she's part of, and I know you've read the book, she's woven throughout the story of my life, because she really is the original ambassador for what it means to live with full self-assurance, full confidence. And I started my company in September of 2013, so a little more than 10 years ago, with a mission to catalyze confidence. And in part doing that, one of the things I write about in chapter 6 of my book is what are the strengths that you need to start your own business. And of the 8 qualities that we've identified quantitatively, they were leading, which is I'm in charge, performing, I'm extroverted, creating, I can create something from nothing, I see possibility and ideas and vision, and self-sustaining. I like myself, I know my value, I know my worth. And if I could go back in time in the DeLorean and take the quiz in 2013 when I was starting my business, I would have realized I had 3 of those 4 qualities. By the way, I, through the process of writing the book, have developed the 4th because I realized I needed it. So I've actually actively been working on that 4th one. But when I started it, I had the ingredients of vision, idea, being able to work through tough challenges and set direction and inspire followership. And part of being an entrepreneur is you have to advocate for yourself and your idea. So all of those pieces, when we did our quantitative research on confidence, I was really happy to see how the data set fell out, that I started with at least 3 of the 4 things you need to get into business on your own. But it is a very hard transition to get rid of the safety net of corporate America. I also, by the way, got to leave behind systemic bias, some of the things that didn't work in my life. That was freeing. I think anyone who started their own company realizes that you get to define the rules of the game and eliminate any systemic structural challenges that you felt impeded your own success. It also meant, though, that there's no external validation or a safety net. You got to learn. And that's the 4th quality of confidence, self-sustaining, that I've been working on, that it's really about redefining how you measure your own success.
Well, especially early on, because you're building something from nothing, right? And so you don't have that. The market doesn't, they may be waiting for what you have. Maybe there's a market there. It just takes time to build, right? So it could be 2 or 3 years before people go, wait, you're onto something. And so if you can't self-sustain, don't have that purpose, you're in trouble.
Well, right? You created a podcast, so you know how hard it is, right? To do something until you know you have an audience or the people to come on board. What I would say is that you write the book you most need to read yourself. And through my lived experience of growing up with immigrant entrepreneur parents and seeing them struggle and seeing what it takes to have the grit to create something from nothing, spending 11 years in corporate America and learning what it is to climb the ladder, both the positive and the things that really held me back. And then the last decade of being an entrepreneur, all of those 2 decades of lived experience plus my childhood added up to the ability to create in this book connection points for anyone in their life stage, right? There are all these moments of self-doubt that we feel. And why I wrote the book was I wanted people to take these moments of self-doubt and turn them into bursts of self-belief and self-confidence. I really think my lived experience has informed how well it connects with so many different people.
I agree. I mean, the book definitely resonated for me. Your story resonates. And I think when you talked about leaving corporate America and leaving some of the not perfect parts of corporate America, whether that's bias or politics, et cetera, that you talk about in the book, there's a tripled standard that women face. And I'd love to just hear a little bit more about that. And if that's something you see as different, sure. Obviously, in your own company.
In our quantitative, and then we did, after we did the research study, we did do 32 focus groups because we did want to double click on one of the insights of the data. By the way, it's so fun to do focus groups during COVID. People just are so open and willing to give you 2 hours of the time because they're stuck at home, and online chat rooms, Zooms, like it's really fun to just get into the dark stuff. But one of the things we realized when we did this was I had started reading this study by Kelly Hsu, who's a professor at the Yale School of Management. She looked at 30,000 employee records. She found that women were consistently rated the highest on performance and results, but the lowest on promotion potential. And men were the reverse. They were very promotable, but they did not deliver the highest levels of performance or results. And when we double-clicked on this data, and then our own data set, and we started interviewing people about their experiences, we realized that women have to be three things at the same time: competent, confident, and warm. And you take away any one of those and they're labeled. So you take away confident and you're a doormat. You take away warmth and you're aggressive. Obviously, competence, I feel like, is the ticket to play if the ante at the table for a woman. But what was so fascinating was we get credit for competence and confidence, but not warmth. It's not on the HR scorecard, just assumed that we have to also be giving and empathetic. And by the way, those are the qualities that got most of us and most of our companies through the pandemic, male, female, non-binary, but they're not necessarily always on the scorecard equally. It's almost what you said earlier. Confidence is the number one criteria by which we define promotability. Then it's your competence. And by the way, warmth isn't included, but I assume women have to have it.
You're so right, because if a woman is not warm, is more assertive, maybe more blunt, oh, well, now she's aggressive. These things pop up and it becomes like, well, she's not playing well in the sandbox. But with men, it doesn't happen as much. So it's such a double standard on that. I totally agree with you. I love that model. I think that'll really resonate with folks. It resonates with me as you talk about that. The other thing you talked about in the book is sort of, you don't believe in the fake it till you make it, which we kind of talked about performative confidence. So kind of double click on that a little bit more. And you talk about confidence language, which I thought was interesting. So just what is confidence language?
I do want to just add one more thing to what you just said, which is when men are warm, they get extra points for it. The interesting thing around the motherhood penalty and the daddy bonus, right? I think that happens a lot, which is when a man has a kid, oh, wow, he deserves a promotion. He needs the money, you know, or wow, he's such a good father. He's taking the afternoon off to go do this. But when women do that, they're penalized for it. So I do think it translates the other way for men, that when they are warm or empathetic, for some reason, they get extra credit. When I come back to your question on the confidence language, if you come back to where we started, which is confidence is about understanding and appreciating your own abilities. I think that we are born fully self-confident. Ask any 5-year-old what they're the best at in the world, and they'll tell you, I'm the best at soccer, I'm the best at hugs, I'm the best at everything. Because as a child, you haven't learned how to compare, despair. You don't have a self-awareness about your flaws or your doubts. In chapter 2 of the book, we identified 6 forces that hold people back. They pop up between the ages of 8 and 12. They pop up in your adolescence. Men, women, everybody, non-binary, everybody has these 6 forces that hold them back, and they form the basis of an inner critic, one that stays with you for the rest of your life. And so if you fast forward as an adult, if I asked you what you're the best at in the world, and again, that's the true basis, having a mindset that you know what you bring to the table before it becomes a behavior, you're stumped. Most people are stumped when I say, what are you the best at in the world? They're like, I haven't thought, but if I tell you what your flaws are, you got a long list of your flaws. We went on this journey to say, can we help people articulate the answer to that question? Because you can't be confident. You can't perform until you truly believe it in yourself. So fake it to make it. I faked it for most of my 20s and 30s that I was a confident person. Didn't mean that I wasn't insecure and focused on external validation. I don't like that phrase because it belittles what real confidence is, which is a mindset, making a choice as an adult to say, I'm going to break out of these six forces that hold us back. I'm going to see the best in myself. Again, you can't receive the compliment until you've been able to pay it to yourself. And then now I can show it to the world. It's like an iceberg. 10% is visible. That's the behavior we can see. 90% of it is below the waterline. It's thoughts, values, feelings, things that we need. And you really have to do that work before you then can say, now I'm not faking that I am assertive. I genuinely believe in myself and believe in what I'm saying. And so the confidence language concept came out when we identified 8 types of confidence, 8 superpowers. Most of us have 2 or 3. My mom took the quiz. She has all 8. You can take the quiz at myconfidencelanguage.com. But your combination of superpowers, your combination of talents, what you're the best at in the world, form the basis of your confidence language. It intentionally sounds like a love language. You got to be aware of the things you bring to the table before you can answer my question, what are you the best at in the world?
Well, I love the fact that you are so right that we can't answer that question, or we're too humble, or we just haven't thought about it, but we can give you 15 different things I've got to get better at tomorrow.
Or you know what else happens? You're too humble, but also you might not think your superpower carries value. A lot of people would come up to me and say, oh, my superpower is so boring. I get things done and I'm kind to other people. Why is that boring? And I come back to the Janet Yellen example or the scorecards by which we define success. I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't get anything done on time. I'm not as giving or as warm. Can you come work with me? Because those are superpowers I want on my team. So it's interesting. We either don't see it in ourselves, but by the way, your best friend probably sees it in you. Or we've, as a society, have deemed some superpowers not as valuable. And that's why these 8 superpowers we've identified, they're a more complete and inclusive way for people to see themselves and to feel good about themselves.
I love that. And I think the superpowers, I want to talk more about those. And I can't go through all 8, of course. But one thing that I thought was nice is that you not only talked about the superpower, but that if we overuse a superpower, it can become a liability. Right. And so how to course correct. And so maybe talk a little more about what are those common superpowers that we overuse, or did I miss it? Did I get it wrong or did I read the book?
Do you mind? Because I feel like your listeners are going to be like, oh, she breadcrumbed me. Can you just list the 8 superpowers? You mind if I list them really quickly? Because I feel like people are going to be really annoyed if I don't at least just say them. They're like, I have to go buy her book or take her quiz. Let me do that. And then I can talk about the course corrections in the context of those 8. The 8 that we identified quantitatively were leading. I set direction, I'm in charge, I inspire followership. Performing, it's what we're doing right now. I'm extroverted, I don't mind being the center of attention. I love the energy exchange between 2 people. Those 2 are the ones most written about. They represent less than 20% of America. And that is really why we kept going, because I said, that means 80% of us have been taught to feel bad about ourselves because we don't fit the mold of the word confidence. Because it's always defined as leading and performing. The next 2 are achieving. I get things done. I have a winner's mindset. I love to set goals and meet or exceed them. Practice makes perfect. If I fail, I try again. And knowing, I'm the smartest, most well-researched, most thoughtful person in the room. I always say you want to build IKEA furniture with someone who has knowing as a superpower. Those 2 are best expressed by the 3 women from the movie Hidden Figures. How do 3 Black women at NASA have the confidence to stand in the room where they're not in charge? It's because they were achieving and knowing. They got things done. They were the smartest people to do the calculations to send a man into space. The next 2 are believing and giving. So giving makes sense. I'm empathetic. I support and nurture others. Believing, I'm an optimist. I see the best in others and others and situations. If things don't work out, they weren't meant to be. The best example of that in modern pop culture is Ted Lasso. Ted Lasso actually says in 1, I've been underestimated my whole life because I'm not a commander coach. I am not here to win or lose. I'm here to help everyone be the best versions of themselves. And so by 3, that believe poster, and just think about the way he led differently than a traditional coach that we see on screen. And then the last 2 are creating and self-sustaining. Creating is my 1. I believe in things before I can see them. I envision the future. I create things from nothing. And self-sustaining, which we talked about earlier, I like myself. I don't need to impress you. I see my value. It's the quality most needed to overcome criticism and to ask for a favor or a raise, because you need to be able to say, here's my market value. if you don't want to give it to me, you can say no. I will find somebody who will, because I actually really know my value in the world. But together, these eight start to change the way we think about a self-affirming inventory of who we are. And once you know it, you can't unsee it. It forms the basis of why you should believe in yourself, why you should take risks, why you should be courageous. To come back to your original question, any of these superpowers can be too much of a good thing. So for example, my little brother is self-sustaining and I'm performing. If you're performing, you're too extroverted sometimes. It's all about you. You take up all the airtime and space in a room, leaving no room for other people. And so I always say you can balance out your performing with other types of superpowers so you listen better. Or leading. If you're too in charge, it could be it's my way or the highway, and you don't leave room for people to have their fingerprints on the journey. Any one of these superpowers, while they're awesome and you really need to be able to see yourself when you take the quiz, they also can lean on being too much. So whether it's knowing, I do think we should know all eight because we can see ones we don't have in other people. We can, even if they don't become superpowers, we can at least learn to do some of them when necessary to connect with others or when a situation asks us to bring a different set of talents to the table.
Yeah, I think it's really helpful. And thank you for going through all eight superpowers. I know it's sometimes a lot to do, so I think that's great you did that. And we'll not be now accused of being breadcrumbing. But you should probably buy the book anyways. I think people will actually buy the book. And I think when you talk about the superpowers, though, it's also good to know them because if you really want to shift who you are, because I think we're more malleable than people believe. Like, I don't believe that just because I had this career or this is what I've done in the past is what my future is going to be. It's a lot of work to change. But if you know the superpowers, what you're saying is, hey, I can try to work on that like you have, right? And so is that kind of how you think about the superpowers? I really want to get better at knowing or execution. Do you believe people can do that?
Works a few different ways and why the confidence language concept becomes powerful in your life. First of all, it's not a personality test. It's not static, right? It's not like your Myers-Briggs type. It's supposed to be an inventory of where you are, where you want to go. I always say when you take the quiz the first time, first of all, a lot of people go, oh my gosh, I have four, I have five. Is there a grading bias, right? Is this overinflating? And I said, maybe you've been underestimating or underleveraging yourself your whole life. We sometimes don't take credit for what we want. So I always say the first thing is when you look at it, ask yourself two questions. One, am I giving myself credit for how powerful I am and advocating for the things I bring to the table? And the other one is what I'm doing with my life right now lined up with my superpowers? I can tell you now that if I could go take the quiz in the 2000s, I would realize that the superpowers required to succeed at McKinsey did not line up with the superpowers I naturally love and the ones that light me up inside. And so, for example, my superpowers are leading, performing, creating, and I'm working on self-sustaining. I do have giving, but I don't score high on knowing. Do you think to be a great management consultant, you have to love process and data and research? I certainly know how to do it, and it's something that I did for 11 years, but it didn't make me happy. So one way is to say, do the superpowers I have line up with what I want to do, what makes me where I am in life? The second thing you can do with it is in chapter 6 of my book, we took 30 situations in life and we correlated in our quantitative work which superpowers you need for which situation. I already shared one, which is how to start your own business. And you can look at it and you can say, huh, I really want one of these 30 situations in my life. Do I already have that superpower? Yes. Okay. I just need to believe that I have it and trust my own judgment. Or two, I don't have it. And this is the third step. Do I want to develop it? Or do I want to hire someone on my team who has that superpower? Again, I only have four, possibly four and a half of them. Most of my team has an opposite confidence language to me. And I love that. I love that now you don't have to be extroverted to work with me. What you do have to do is complement what I bring to the table. If we all led and performed the way I did and created things, nothing would get done. So most of my team members have achieving, knowing, giving, believing, right? They have a different set of superpowers. And I really honor that. Even in my family relationships, I shared with you, my brother and I have opposite confidence languages, and it's changed our relationship. When we go to dinner in the past, he's more introverted than I am. I'd say, Are you having fun? Are you enjoying? He said, if I weren't having fun, I would have left by now. Stop asking me that question. He says, I know now that performing is your superpower. So every 30 minutes, I'll just say, I'm having a good time. Just so we can get it out of the way and we can move on, because I know you need that validation from an audience. By the way, that's why I'm working on self-sustaining too. It's not just because you need it to handle the setbacks, but also because my brother says, why don't you like yourself? Why do you need me to tell you that I'm having fun? You can just feel it. Or if, are you having fun? Oh yeah, I am having fun. So why am I asking him if he is?
Right. Makes a lot of sense. I mean, obviously, depending on where your superpowers are, that you may be looking for that from others, right? And vice versa. And one of the superpowers, or one of the things you brought up earlier, which I think is really interesting, is about being quiet or introverted. Because as you said, like 20% of America, and we focus a lot on confidence and extroversion, but if you're introverted, and I'm thinking about for HR people sometimes, HR leaders that might be more introverted, more quiet leaders in terms of how can you still convey gravitas, but yet be introverted? Like, what's that look like?
I call it less about being extroverted and more learning the tools of self-advocacy and standing in your own power and not feeling like you have to apologize for the fact that you don't fit in the mold. One of my bosses, very early on, when we were introducing ourselves for a team intro, she said, I'm an introvert and it's my superpower. She literally said this. This was 2001. And she said, when we do team meetings and whatnot, you may think that I'm not engaged, but what I'm really doing is I'm listening. I'm listening very deeply for what's going on. I have a hard time processing things in the moment. I will write everything down and 2 days later come back to you with the most thoughtful responses to your questions or things that were brainstorming. I don't love whiteboarding, so one of you will always take the pen. I won't be able to make a decision in the moment, but I know myself and that 2 to 3 days later, the decision will be really thoughtful, really well researched. Being an introvert's an asset to this team because you guys are all going to talk all day long, or you all will talk all day long, and I will be sitting here getting the reserves of power from my own thought process. Doesn't mean I don't value team problem solving. It doesn't mean I don't love the exchange that we're going to have. It will just seem like I'm not engaged, but I really am. I am here. And I loved how unapologetic she was, but she didn't miss the opportunity to advocate for the power of being an introvert. So she reframed over 20 years ago how I see introverts. I see them as incredibly powerful. They just don't react in the moment the way I do. And so as HR professionals, one of the things I always say is we have to expand the scorecard of success. We might have to encourage introverts, look, to be successful here, when you're in an executive meeting, you are going to have to practice performing skills. But as opposed to telling someone to be more confident, by the way, that's ambiguous, anxiety-inducing. You can say of the 8 superpowers to succeed here, you are going to have to learn once a month performing skills because that's what it takes to win here. And we start to take ownership of our learning journey. We start to give more definition to the code word of gravitas or confidence, because I do think it is code. When someone tells you to be more confident, it's really through the lens of the beholder's confidence language. It's be more like me. But now we can say more concretely, I need you to be more self-sustaining. Don't spiral. That person gave you the feedback because they care about you. Please know that you're valuable, that we see your worth. And the only reason you're getting this feedback is because we want to make you better. We want to take you to the next level. Self-sustaining, that's why it's so powerful in overcoming criticism or setback. Hey, I know I'm valuable. I know what I bring to the table. So your criticism is not a stick of dynamite. It's a gift to make me even better. Those are the types of ways in which we can change HR conversations. Not, you don't seem to be too confident in meetings. Hey, you could really improve your performing skills in future meetings. And that's how we give introverts power and recognize what they bring to the table, but also help them develop and grow in the context of whatever culture they're stepping into.
Yeah, lots to unpack there, Lisa. I love your example that your boss, an introvert, you know, she's unapologetically said, hey, I'm an introvert, but there's power in that. And this is how I operate. Because I think knowing yourself as a leader and being confident enough to say, this is how I'm going to operate. I'm not going to take the pin on a whiteboard is very empowering to your team. All right, she's got gravitas. Like, that's great. You know, it makes sense.
I will also say, though, the power of the introvert, if you gave her a 30-page PowerPoint deck to review, she would print it out. She would have little like post-it note tabs and stickies, and it would be all marked up. Because I do think that is the power of the introvert, is they think about every single slide. They can pick it apart. And then you'd get it back. And as an extrovert with no voiceover, it's like, oh my gosh, I just totally screwed up. One of the things that I would say to her is, hey, when you do that, could we just have 15 minutes to walk through the comments so I can hear your internal monologue? Because I process out loud. And she said, of course, I'm happy to do that for you because I know you're an extrovert. And I said, I just process things better if we can just talk it out. And she goes, great, but I need to do my homework. before so that that doesn't raise my anxiety levels of having to like do it in the moment. So this is, I think when you talk about HR, we really are able to do this best when both parties know what they're bringing to the table and the strength of it and what they need to succeed.
Yeah. And there's so many different styles because obviously you can be introverted and really highly analytical or introverted and not analytical. So obviously it just depends. But I love that she was just confident who she was as a leader and said, this is my style. And I think that's super important because a lot of times we are expecting people to perform a lot and people are performing sometimes get ahead because they are getting the attention. So that's just a critical piece. The other thing I want to ask you about, thinking about early career HR professionals, as I read your book and McKinsey, you carried around what you called the one thing notebook, which I thought was brilliant. And I wanted to know if you could tell us more about the notebook and how it helped your career.
I always say the mentor chooses you. You don't choose the mentor. Make yourself mentorable. If we want, we can talk about Gen Zers. And I do think Gen Zers have been sold a lie of like lean in, girl boss. They're very performatively confident. They're almost too confident in a room or too outspoken in a room. And I had a Gen Zer on my team. I said, look, I recognize that you've been taught that you need to be in the room and be assertive. It means that you're not allowing me to give you the wealth of experience that I've accumulated and put my fingerprints on your journey. So I need you to be coachable. I need you to be mentorable. So I love the amount of what we would call leading and performing attributes you bring to the table, but you haven't earned the right yet to be able to do that. No hierarchy of ideas, but certainly higher skill set. One thing I did early in my career is I do think people are bad at giving feedback and asking for feedback. It's like when you say to someone, hey, do you have any feedback for me? And they're like, oh, you're doing fine. Just keep doing what you're doing. It's like being in a store when you're like, do you need any help? You're like, I'm just browsing, right? It's just kind of almost dismissive. And what I found more powerful was, hey, what's one thing I could do better? Everybody has one thing. Everybody has one thing. And that question changed the relationships I had with my most important mentors. What's one thing I could do better? And someone will say, oh, yeah, there is one thing. When we do this, I would love to see you do this differently. And I would write it down in the notebook and I would start to practice that. And a few weeks or months, and I would say, could you give me feedback? How do you do it? If I do it in a meeting, can you make sure you follow up if you see it? But it was trackable. So I would go back to that person and say, you know how you asked me to slow down when I present that I went too fast with the numbers? I've been really working on that the last couple of meetings. Have you noticed it? And usually the person's like, yes, and here's one more thing you could do. And I would cross it off each time. That meant, number one, wow, this is someone who is very coachable and wants to grow and not afraid of it, not afraid of it. And the second thing was that person felt like they were more invested in my journey. They had their fingerprints on my success. Like, I have to help Lisa succeed because she is the one person who always comes to me and says, what's one thing? She's actively trying to get better. It also helps I was raised by a tiger mom. It probably came from being raised by a tiger mom. I will tell you, I got A double plus in AP chemistry, which most parents would be so proud of. My mom said, go ask the teacher how much extra credit to get third plus in the system. And I went back to my chemistry teacher and she said, oh my, Lisa, first of all, the system only allows me to be two pluses. I don't want to give you more extra credit because that means I have to grade it. Just I'll handwrite in a third plus and you go and take it back to your mom. So maybe the one thing came from being raised by a tiger mom. Good pluses and minuses to being raised by a tiger mom. But I do think when we can say, hey, what's one thing I could do better? It changes our relationships. That person thinks you're coachable, but you're also now taking ownership of your learning journey. I really don't like the open-ended question of, do you have any feedback for me?
Well, I think you've handled that really well in terms of, that is very similar to what happens in a store. So it's a great analogy. And I think that to your point of asking for that feedback and building that relationship, people are now invested in you as well, especially when you go back and tell them that you've done that. So that is a great tip because that reciprocity builds that relationship and they're more invested in your career and succeeding.
I find it also fascinating when people are shocked when they get a performance improvement plan. When people say, okay, there's 6 months to correct a set of, I always am shocked that people didn't know. And whenever people tell me these stories, I said, well, did you ask for feedback? Did you along the way? We can't read between the lines. One of the things is people stop developing you when they stop talking to you. I always say your best coach is your toughest one, the one that cares enough about you to tell you and wants you to succeed. And so once it gets to a performance improvement plan, it's almost too late, right? Not too late. I know that's why they exist. How much ownership do I take over where I am today? Because if you're asking for little bits of it along the way, you almost don't get to that place. Or when you do get to that place, you're like, yes, this person has told me over and over again, these are things you don't deliver things effectively or on time, or there's always small errors in your work. All of those things, you should have seen that coming. So it shouldn't feel a surprise. Because what ends up happening, people are like, oh, this boss is standoffish with me. They're not really treating me well. And then you get the performance improvement plan. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is what they think of me. We're not conditioned to be strong enough to go and ask for it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And if you get to the performance improvement plan and they haven't given you that feedback, it's a surprise. It's a little bit on that manager, obviously, because they should have given you feedback along the way. But obviously for you as that individual, I think what you're really saying with the One Thing Notebook is, how do I get better like 1% every day? I mean, the best performers, the high potentials, the high performers are like, hey, I know I can get better. What's one thing? And I think that's the right attitude. And so hopefully we're not, you know, that's who we're focused on mostly. And of course, if you're on the PIP, it's a different situation. But I love the fact of just that one thing. So I think it's a great takeaway. But Lisa, I have one last question for you. And you know, this is an HR podcast. It's about the future of HR. So I'll give you a second to think about it if you need to. But I always finish all the podcasts with this question. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR in the next 5 to 10 years?
We have to expand the definition of success. We have to define the metrics of success differently. And I always say, what is measured is what is valued. And I wrote this book in part to change the way in which we score people on confidence. And I'm going to speak to women specifically. In order for women to progress, there are two things that have to happen simultaneously. One is the scorecard has to include some of the attributes that are specific to female leadership, whether it's giving or knowing or, you know, or believing. There's all these other qualities that have historically been labeled soft, but I think of them as emotionally intelligent. And we have to start including those on the scorecard. I think this is why a lot of my friends who've gone to work for female CEOs say, it just feels different. It feels like the scorecard looks quite different here. That's one thing. In order for us to truly be inclusive, we have to change the scorecard. That's what is valued in an organization. At the same time, for women, in my case, when I wrote the book, we've been bringing a tennis racket to a baseball game. And so now that we know what the playing field looks like, we have to learn how to swing a bat. So there are a few of these 8 superpowers that I say, look, leading, performing, self-sustaining, those 3 qualities fundamentally changes the equation of your capability in across almost every area. So while I don't want to tell people they have to go play the game, in the near term, those 3 qualities will level you up. And it's because that is how society has defined success. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword here. We've got to expand the scorecard, but we also have to open people's eyes up to what is being scored today and help them have the ability to go after those skills.
Lisa, I love it. I think expanding the definition of success is so critical. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. We're excited for the book, Gravitas, 8 Strengths That Redefine Confidence. It's going to be a great, great one. I know people are really going to enjoy it. So thank you again for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Lisa for sharing her inspiring insights and her advice for HR leaders on how to lean into their superpower and confidence. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe or share our podcast with at least one other person, or even better, leave a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts. This really helps us to grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Jordana Camerud, SVP and CHRO at Corning Incorporated. In my conversation with Jordana, we discuss why taking risks and seeking opportunities is so important, especially early in your career, why you've got to understand the business and deliver business value as an HR leader, and how the CEO and CHRO relationship can focus on aligned purpose, mutual trust, and healthy candor. This was an insightful episode and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to Future of HR and being part of our community.